dear listeners, and welcome to Deutsche Grammophon's international podcast series. I'm Sarah Willis, and I'm happy to be podcasting for you with the Yellow Label's star-studded cast of musicians as my guests. Today, we're at the Deutsche Grammophon offices in Berlin, and there is someone sitting opposite me who I have never met before, but have been dying to ever since I saw him playing Bach in a fish factory. Vikinger Olafsson, willkommen.
Takk, Sarah.
Hvað þér og gott?
Ég segi allt rosalega gott. I'm very well, thank you.
Ah, góðan dag.
Góðan dag, good day to you
thank
too.
Thank you, that's all I can manage. It's really hard.
You've
Icelandic.
Done well.
Yeah, I practiced with YouTube yesterday.
Did you?
Yeah,
well
because I just thought, I love languages. And researching you, I thought, gosh, I know nothing about Icelandic languages because when we go there, everybody speaks English.
Yeah, well, you and I, we used to speak the same language, you know, some 500 years ago.
A long time ago, before it all got very northern and Nordic. And
yeah, you know, I had a roommate at Juilliard who was a drama major, and he was doing all the Shakespeare. And so many of the words that he was looking up, they were practically Icelandic. It's amazing. I mean, Old Norse, the Old English, you know, it was all one.
There's a lot of videos, actually, that I found about how to pronounce all this Icelandic names and places, and it's all these old, the things they use in
just take
in
your time.
Films.
It's like with music, if you have a super difficult phrase, take your time. You have more time than you think. Those words, when people are trying to say, like, the glacier that stopped the whole world from traveling, Eyjafjallajökull.
I was going to impress
part,
you with that.
Part of the problem is that they get so nervous. It's like, you're playing a phrase and you just sort of, like, run ahead of yourself. You have more time than you think.
That's very good advice. Welcome, anyway. I'm so happy to meet you at last. A huge fan for years.
Oh, stop
and,
it.
And in between us, for our podcast audiences, we have Vikingo's wonderful new album, Debussy in Rameau, and it's in a very nice horn. It's my French horn is in between us, and it's acting very beautifully as an album stand.
Could be like industrial design, like your new photo frame is a French horn.
Absolutely, it's what
superb.
A good idea.
Yeah.
And when I'm bored of you, I'll just change you out with the next one.
Exactly. I mean, I have photo frames, but I certainly can't play them. This is a huge improvement.
It is, isn't it? Anyway, congratulations on the new album. I know you are spending a lot of time today. We're here in the Deutsche Grammophon offices, but you're being shunted all across Berlin. You've just come from right on the other side of town.
It's funny. I'm doing, I think, 8 or 9. I can't even count anymore. Different interviews today.
This is and going to be your favorite, I promise.
It already is. But basically, you know, when you're being asked sort of similar questions and then you find yourself, you know, giving similar answers and then you start to feel like a charlatan because you're just saying the same thing again and again and again, trying to find variation, trying to find the freshness. Because also, if you say something, just like when you play music, if you play music and you play it the third constant in a row or fourth or fifth or sixth, you know, it's so hard to find the freshness of the first. It's like a recording. The first take tends to be the best.
But something, I think it was Christoph Eschenbach who said, the best thing about music is it, of course, is never the same because every minute, you're already a minute older and wiser.
Yeah, he said it. I mean, it's like you'd kind of step twice into the same river. It was said 2,000 years before him even. But it's so true. It is so true. But it does change the fact that in a way, when you're saying, yeah, I chose Debussy and Rameau for this album because of, you know, yeah, I have to be very disciplined and we have to find new ways of thinking about it. So let's do that right now.
Let's do that right now and make this the one that everyone is going to run to. Do you do it on stage as well? Do you consciously think, okay, what can I do differently? Or does it just pour out of you?
I do sometimes have to consciously think that I want to do something differently, especially if I'm doing it for the 7th concert in like 8 days. You do sometimes have to do that. But luckily, live is so anyway unstable and pianos
are... You're talking to a horn player.
And pianos also, I mean, they're so different than the acoustics and we have to adapt anyway so much on stage. I mean, I think it would be a completely different story if I was a violinist, had my guarneri or something like that with me.
Yeah, I travel with my instrument. You have a different one wherever you go.
Unfortunately. I mean, if a luxurious position would be to have my chosen technician, you know, with me. That sometimes
some
happens.
Some people do travel.
That sometimes
are you
happens.
Not famous enough yet?
Ooh,
rich enough.
It's a very sensitive issue, of course.
Oh, sorry.
No, sometimes. I mean, sometimes you can have, like, you know, tours organized where you actually have someone like Thomas Hübsch from the Philharmonie or Michel Brandjes from the Concertgebouw. This is a dream. Mm. But that's not, you know, life, you know, every day. So, but anyway, I think that music, anyway, is the music I choose to play is in a way so multifaceted that it's in a way hard to repeat yourself too much. If you play Bach, like 60-minute or 80-minute Bach sets, you know. What kind of person are you if you're actually playing it the same from day to day? I mean, you're certainly not a very good musician.
Of course. But the thing is about an album is that it's different from live because live you can play something and think, oh, I'll play that differently tomorrow. an album, recording an album, I'm a horn player, so I'm always with other people. You're alone in a studio,
yeah.
And you are putting down notes that are going to stay there forever.
Thank you for reminding me. It's really scary, but it's the same when you're composing. You know, I've done some composing, but also when I read like about Debussy on that album, he was agonizing over submitting pieces for publication. Sometimes we think of Debussy and we think, oh, it's just this incredible inspiration. He just sort of like had this kind of freedom inside in this fantasy and can just stay in sonority and find endless different colors, shades of blue, let's say. But it wasn't like that. I mean, he would actually delay and delay and delay giving his pieces for final publication because he wouldn't know if the silence was supposed to be a quarter note, an eighth note, or whether that bar should be slurred or whether it should have, you know. I mean, there are infinite ways. But I think with the recording, you have to, it's a very sort of humbling experience. You have to sort of accept, first of all, yourself, but also the fact that music is bigger than, you know, any one performance. You know, we have this idea in ourselves that, you know, there's one best thing and we are certainly not there, but we are striving for it. But then turns out it's not true. Even if you do the perfect recording, it's not perfect, you know, unless it's there for one day and then tomorrow you think differently. Right now with this, I recorded it in August, so it's now 6 months. So I'm a little weird. It's like when I was just done with it, I was very happy with it. And now I'm in this place when I listen to it and I played it in a few concerts and I just do it very differently. And then, you know, you come back a year later and you might again see it's actually wonderful. And then 2 years you think, oh, it's actually overrated. It's just like the Icelandic weather. It's like constantly changing, you know.
Why is it that Iceland produces such good musicians? Is it because of the weather?
Maybe we stay indoors and like sing songs. No, I think actually like it's coincidental somewhat. Maybe we are lucky because right now we are in a point of time where it's quite nice not to have the burden of history too much, you know, bearing on your shoulders. I think we have an interesting culture, super intense, but at the same time, it's very young. And so classical music, I mean, it goes back only to the late 19th century, or early 20th, really. And then people were writing like quasi-Schumann or Grieg pieces still, when Schoenberg was like breaking down tonality. And
they were still romantic.
Oh, they were still like in like Robert Schumann early pieces, you know. So it's very interesting, you know. But then in the last few years, you know, we've had an explosion of music's different styles, different artists. And there's no way of explaining it, but maybe the weather is as good as any other explanation.
The food, maybe.
I'm not sure. Maybe it's like, it's just like a pretty difficult place to be in. I mean, it's the most wonderful place on earth.
But we loved it. We went to play at the concert.
It's like, it's so moody, you know. The country, like the weather, the conditions, everything is so up and down. Because we have such a small economy and we have our own currency, it's like the swings are crazy. And like everything is just like in constant state of like flux. I mean, it's just like there's no stability there. I feel like it's like, you know, like Italy of the north or something. Like it's like there's never a moment of calm somehow.
Well, they certainly produce some amazing musicians.
Instability is good. Maybe instability is the key.
For artists.
For art. I mean, think about it. I mean, some of the greatest art has always been created in sort of unstable circumstances. Too much prosperity and too much stability can kill art quite easily. You know, it kills ideas. You know, it kills the need to break away and to change things.
Yeah. On your album, Debussy and Rameau, you say this is like a dialogue between the two composers, and it would be great if you didn't even notice that you were playing Rameau or Debussy. If you got into that mix and the three of you were in a bar, what would that conversation be like, do you think? Because actually, in your program notes, you called Rameau the bad boy of Baroque, and Debussy was this sort of tortured impressionist. He didn't really like that word impressionist, did he? You don't like that word, really, impressionist.
Nobody likes it.
So what would you put yourself in the mix with these two?
Oh, wow. I mean, with two Frenchmen like that in a bar, I mean, I'm sure it would be very interesting. They would probably be, you know, insulting each other and having a wonderful debate about something. I would probably just sort of observe it and drink a little more. Honestly, no, but I think, you know, what these two guys have in common are quite a few things. They were sort of relentlessly independent and individual thinkers. You know, they always had to find their way. They wouldn't just accept other people's ways. So for instance, they both arrived into a scene, you know, of their day that they thought was quite tired. So when Debussy was a young man, he was totally not buying the Camille Saint-Saëns scene. He wasn't buying the Fauré way. He wasn't buying what César Franck was doing. He didn't like any of those things. Chausson was maybe the closest, but he really had to reinvent things. And there was a year in Debussy's life in the 1880s when he was in his 20s, when he actually didn't compose for a whole year because he felt everything coming from his pen was like Wagnerian. So because Wagner was then like the god of music. And so he always had to find his own way, and he would never do things sort of automatically. He would question everything. He would question the meaning of every single piece, which is why, I mean, he really made himself invent the wheel all the time, yeah. Very many different kinds of wheels. But Rameau, on the other hand, you know, he sort of comes from the provinces. He's almost like self-taught. And, you know, he's in the Age of Enlightenment. You know, he was called the Newton of Harmony because he really sort of invented this way of thinking about harmony, you know, really thinking about harmony as we perceive it today.
And people didn't quite accept it, did they, in those days? He was considered a little bit of a rebel.
I think so. And I think great art doesn't connect people, it divides people.
Oh.
I think so. I think if it's really great art, it divides people. Which is why I hope I don't only get positive reviews for this. Please also bring in the negative ones, because we need that. We need a discussion about things. You know, people need to take a stance. And that's maybe something that we miss from today's, you know, classical music and society in general. But those days, it was really a heated debate, you know. So if you put those two guys in a bar, certainly I'll just be the bartender. I'm just going to listen to what they have to say and bring them some interesting drinks. You know?
Rameau, so Simon Rattle, my ex-boss, we did Rameau with him, the wonderful orchestral pieces. And he said Rameau was a rock star in his day for these rhythms and for these unusual percussion effects that he would bring in there. You know, there's even those chains and all the crazy things.
I think he's giving way too much credit to rock and the rock stars because I know some rock stars and they're not this cool, to be honest with you. I think this idea of saying that everything is rock and roll and rock star in classical music is pretty lame, actually. I think nothing against Sir Simon, I'm a huge fan of his. But really, I think this notion, I don't find that kind of amazing life in much rock. Of course, you can say some exceptions, for sure. But I'd say he was his own different kind of a star in his own kind of firmament. You know, it's really music of the future. You can look to Rameau just like you look at the stars to find which direction you're going in. I do find that. And I find that the keyboard music in particular, which is almost never played or recorded on the modern piano, the grand piano, it's really, you know, up there with Johann Sebastian Bach. I prefer it to even the suites of Handel or the sonatas of Scarlatti. And I don't say that lightly because I do love those pieces. But what Rameau has done in those pieces is really, you know, it's this kind of Baroque and very specific French Rameau Baroque way of writing for piano, but really with the kind of spirit of what was to come in the Romantic era. And he gives those pieces these kind of incredibly expressive titles, Dialogue of the Birds.
It's really program music, you know? La Poule, Cyclops, chicken. You know?
Yeah, it's like, the hen. I mean, it's the Cyclops and this, I mean, these titles, they're just like poems, yeah. Like one-line poems. Yeah. And so in a way, he's way ahead of his time in many ways. And also with keyboard writing, think about the first Rameau piece on this album is Le Rappel des Oiseaux, or Dialogue of the Birds, where you certainly have one bird in the right hand and another one in the left hand. They do have a dialogue.
It was a bit Messian almost,
it's incredible.
Yeah.
Incredible. Messian takes a lot from Rameau.
Yeah.
And it starts with, you know, just an E minor chord, and it just stays in that chord for quite a long time. And then it just changes it just by one note or two notes, but still, and then stays in that sonority, and the birds are just in there, and they're just sort of sitting there quietly on the branch together, having a little dialogue, and then they fly off, and you see all the landscapes, and you see the other creatures of the forest, and wherever they go in transit. But I mean, this kind of music can do this with Rameau so early in the Baroque. I mean,
it was very unusual for those days, because most people were just writing symphonies, movement 1, 2, 3, or whatever, or dances,
yeah.
or songs, but so the words would do the work, but in his music, it's so descriptive. It's really quite extraordinary. And I must say, listening to the album, I've rediscovered it because, you know, unfortunately, there are no Rameau. Well, Rameau wrote some very difficult horn parts, but never any solo pieces. Oh, we've sweated on stage with some of his horn parts. Oh, goodness. But the fact that this descriptive writing, you know, this program music writing. Yeah, it really is.
I think Debussy also, in much of his piano music, is really like a theater director almost. He's just like painting these scenes, or a painter, of course, in sound. But he's directing these scenes. And so in a way, the way this album is set up is really like a composition, like almost like an opera or like a dialogue, an opera for two players, you know, the two composers having a dialogue, one listening to another, and then adding something to the conversation, furthering it. But it opens with an overture, La Damoiselle Élue, which
is
originally
played. I was
originally, the cantata from the 1880s.
Yeah.
Debussy was a young man, and I thought his side, the old side of him, because he was also very much a man of the past as well as a man of the future. He was not only interested in Impressionism and these kind of like, that's very simplistic, you know. He loved Japanese prints. He loved the pre-Raphaelite painters. He was obsessed with the past. And it starts with this kind of archaic prelude that I've taken from his own transcription for solo piano much later in his life, which shows how much he loved this piece still. And then, you know, it's like the curtains are drawn, and then, you know, at the end of the prelude, and I've changed the ending to be like in the original orchestral piece where the chorus sort of enters instead of the piano ending that he gave it. So this is complete uncertainty. And in my mind, the curtains are sort of, you know, removed to the side. And what appears on the scene is not Debussy, but Rameau. And
you have
like a, yeah, like a village, yeah. like a French village in the 18th century, like somewhere in Normandy or something. Like, it's really like a village, and you have these scenes, and you have the tambourines, you have the folksy music, folksy elements, you have the village maiden that I like to play, like she's like a totally, like she's a teaser, she's a flirt.
Yeah.
She's not one who gets, you know, her heart broken. She's a heartbreaker. Like, she's not the victim. Like, she's very often played in a very sort of sad way. Like, we should feel bad for her. I don't think so. She's much more like the young Mott Arkert. She's just like, it's incredible, like, incredible charisma. Like, everyone just looks at her and they can't just grasp her, you know. She's an enigma, really. And then it goes, you know, after the E minor suite finishes with these two gigs, which are like Schubert almost, going from minor to major. And really, the E minor version is really like Eine Krähe from Winterreise. It's just like incredible. It's incredible, like prophetic music. Then all of a sudden, we find ourselves in another kind of village or another kind of garden, you know, Rain in the Garden of Debussy from Estampes. And from there, we go on, and I specifically chose pieces to reflect Debussy and his deep roots in the French Baroque, and to show kind of the more futuristic, perhaps.
And you finish with his homage, which is the perfect piece, the homage to Rameau.
Yeah, what do you think about the homage? Because it's an interesting piece. Do you find similarities between Rameau and Debussy?
To be honest,
there?
It's on paper, it's a great finish, but listening to it, I was like, okay, what is he actually doing from Rameau? My first listen through was actually, I was thinking, okay, maybe I'm missing something here. I didn't quite get it.
It's amazing. I think it's...
Oh, so am I useless as a musician? I felt really disappointed in myself.
Yeah, you're fired.
I didn't quite get it.
You're no longer part of the Berlin Philharmonic.
But I knew that I was going to come and talk to you about it today. So will you please tell me what I...
Actually,
what
you have nailed it, because the similarities are not obvious. But wouldn't it also have been so cliché to write homage
of
a Rameau and try to do like a Rameau saraband? Mm. Of course, the piece is kind of a saraband, but it's a very spacious saraband. And it's full of these kind of like staple, like, bass sonorities that he then builds these, I would allow myself to say, very nostalgic music around. Mm. It's certainly reflective, this homage to Rameau, and it's sort of like looking through the fogginess of time. And I think it's so beautiful, because I've thought about this piece so much, and I love it, like, I love it to death, really. I really love this music. I think it's one of Debussy's greatest pieces. But again, where is Rameau in it? I think it's the beautiful thing is that if you really respect someone, and if someone has really been your teacher, you don't sound like your teacher.
Yeah, you don't have to copy.
You are yourself, and that's the greatest thing you can do for your teacher or someone that your mentor. And Debussy loved Rameau, and he studied him so detailed, in such a detail. So in a way, what he's done there is he's giving him this kind of bow, you know, without trying to pretend to be a mini Rameau, and that's beautiful.
I'm so glad that you helped me with that. Thank you.
You can feel free to listen to it again without finding what exactly.
I certainly will.
I don't think there is any, there's no, as far as I'm concerned, there's no citation, there's no quotation, there's no little place in
it's
there.
It's a nod.
It's just
it's a nod.
Yeah. It's just a fantasy.
Yeah. And if you go back to the middle, I have another question from a horn player. The Arts and the Hours, which had a terribly complicated full name. It was The Arrival of the Muses, Saviors, the Seasons, and Hours and the Arts. That's what it was originally called.
Well, it's all about the arrival or to the scene of something related to the arts or to time.
Yeah.
And time's passing.
In the credits, it says you've arranged it. Now, can you explain that to me and to people that maybe don't quite understand what it means to be playing a piece by Rameau on the modern-day piano?
Yeah, I mean, with this piece, I arranged it because I think it's one of the most beautiful pieces from the Baroque era, I mean, of all music. It's incredible. It could almost have been written the kind of harmonies and the counterpoint and dissonance you have in there and cross suspensions could almost have been written by Gustav Mahler. You know, it's so futuristic, it's so timeless, and he was 80 years old when he wrote it. So he became a very old man, especially for that time, you know, 80, and he died when he was 81. It's his last opera, Le Boréad. And I just thought, you know, I sometimes conduct like Mozart concertos from the piano, but I'm not as good as Sir Simon Rattle or something like that. So in a way, I'm not going to be conducting this piece, but I do envy that conductors who do. Mm-hmm. So I found a way of sort of getting rid of my envy, just being able to play it on the piano. And when you do a transcription like that, you know, taking something original like for string orchestra or for a bigger orchestra and then making it in for the piano medium, it's very important that you do so from a position of strength, that you think that you actually can make something new out of it, because I'm not interested in certainly only imitating what has been done, because then you should just stay with the original. And I thought with this choice, I imagined it could be just get new sonority, new life on the piano. The original is so beautiful. It's one of the most beautiful pieces of the Baroque period, you know. But really, I am jealous of the conductors who get to conduct it. I really do. But now I don't need to be jealous anymore because I can just
play it. You can play it. They're jealous of you.
But it's like the music. I mean, what did he do in this piece? It's Le Boréad. It's his last opera. He was 80 years old. He had finally gotten some fame and some money, actually, but it didn't change anything about his very modest way of living and being. And he writes this incredible music that could just as well have been written by Gustav Mahler 120 years later. I mean, this kind of suspensions, these harmonies, this sort of timeless quality. It's I think it's unbelievable quality of music. So I've put this there and called it The Arts and the Hours. You know, for the gods at Spotify and Apple Music, certainly.
They don't have to write out the entire title.
But also for myself.
Yeah.
Because I thought about it, you know, and there's this timeless and this kind of quality and this tranquility and acceptance in this piece, very much an acceptance. And I feel like it was inspired, The Arts and the Hours. Well, of course, it's in the original title, but it's also sort of inspired by Ars longa, vita brevis. You know, life is short, art is long. He's at the end of his life. And I mean, in a way, this whole album is about the, you know, the elusiveness of time and, you know, whether two composers like those can be kind of like musical brothers or even soulmates, you know, even if 180 years separate them. I certainly know that Debussy felt that way. We have a harder time knowing what Rameau felt about Debussy, of course.
He would have loved him.
I think so. But you never know with two Frenchmen.
I also wanted to congratulate you on the video because I absolutely loved it. It was so touching. I literally watched it three times. I watched it three times to make sure I got the three characters exactly.
Oh, the new video,
right.
The new video. Right.
The fish video I loved. For any listeners who don't know, Vikingo's fish video, please look it up. It is beautiful. This face, this smile of the fish. Well, it's not really a smile. I guess he was dead. But
it's your interpretation.
It's beautiful. I thought the fish was smiling and saying,
I think
you know,
he can smile in posterity.
Yeah, of course. That's his death mask. But and people who haven't seen it will not know what on earth we're talking about. But if you haven't seen it, go and look it up. But the music video to accompany this piece is also very, very beautiful. You work with the same director.
Yeah.
And he has a very peaceful, beautiful outlook on the world somehow. I just like what he did with the music as well.
It's really about, this video is about following your passion, following your heart. It's about sort of, it's in two, there are sort of like two elements, or I should say four elements, but it's me playing this music in the home of
beautiful
Halldór
house.
Laxness.
Yeah.
It's a mid-century classic house, famous house. Halldór Laxness was Iceland's only Nobel Prize-winning author, a great, great, great author. And he passed away in 1998, and his house is still exactly the way it was. His typewriter is there, time stands still. So it felt perfect for The Arts and the Hours and the Ars longa vita brevis. Mm-hmm. But then we have, for every verse, we have a different character. We have a little visual counterpoint to the music. And we have three characters appearing who have such different passions. But you see this kind of gathering over a long period of time of these things that they love and they really, you know, are closest to their hearts. I'm not going to say what those objects are, and this is going to be very surprising to some. But
beautiful.
But I thought it was, I mean, it's sort of like, yeah, it's really about sort of quiet passion.
I love that about you, that you go in these different you know, directions, your remix. You know, you said you have nothing against remixes if they're good, and then you bring out a Bach remix. And then here, this music video with a different message. It's just not like the, hey, look at me, this is my new album, but with a story.
Well, that's been done so many times. And it's, I think, really, I mean, when you do an album like that, you should try to find a way for creativity not only to be in the way you play the music and what you select, but rather in also the visuals, the text you should write yourself, for sure, about the music, and the time you spend with it. Everything is translated then into into something else. And I think with the videos, yeah, I think classical music videos can be awful. and I think, you know, if you burn for the music and you want to say something new with the music, you should also want to say something new with the video, which means not just going into a nice little palace and putting on a suit and, you know, combing your hair and then playing something for your mother. You know, you should do something else, or your grandmother.
Hear, hear. Your mother will love your new video, I think.
We'll see.
Yeah? Will she let you know?
She's very honest, yeah.
Will she let you know?
I don't want everybody to love everything, honestly. I think people should make up their own minds, and I think we need that more. I think it's totally fine to accept that not everything is equal in music. We don't have to say that, let's say, Beethoven, we have the Beethoven year. So everyone is doing these complete editions, including my beloved Deutsche Grammophon. But it doesn't mean that I like all the Beethoven piano sonatas. I actually don't. I think they're very uneven in quality, and some people in Vienna will shoot me for saying this, you know.
But you're allowed to say that.
I think so, and it's like it's the same. I don't buy all the Bruckner symphonies at all. You know, some of them I absolutely love, but in other words, I can't stand.
That's why it's so individual.
I think we need people to be more honest and more free about making up their own minds and taking sort of being more a little bit like Rameau and Debussy, finding what speaks to them. And so in a way, I've done videos that speak to me, but I realize they might not speak to other people. But that's the way with everything.
Your son loves what you do, though. Does he sit under the piano when you practice?
He does. And he's already given me like a fugue theme that I should probably compose to. He's 11 months old, so maybe I'm exaggerating.
Can you sing
but
it for
played,
me?
I'm not going to sing it to you, but but it's actually, I'll play it on the horn.
Oh,
but
yeah,
it's actually, it's a four-note motif, you know, F, D, E, E flat, which sounds very like, and he played it like that with his fingers, like just like, it's so beautiful. And then I thought, we don't need the B-A-C-H Bach theme anymore. We can just go with, you know, F-D-E E flat, the theme of my son. I'm trying to figure out what he's trying to tell me. It must be some cryptic message in there.
Yes, there must be. Okay, well, I'm expecting the symphony, your son's symphony, using like instead of D-S-C-H or something like that. Like, so that's your new challenge.
Yeah, now I sound like an insane parent, like trying to make an insane wunderkind of my son.
I wonder if your son might like to play the horn when he grows up, because I saw a picture of him. He's got great set of chops. Yeah, he really does.
You mean just the lips?
Yeah, just the lips. He looked like he's looking in like this in the camera, and I thought, yeah, there we go.
Oh, super.
Yeah.
I never thought of that.
I'll have to come
by.
I
only think about the fingers, and he's actually got some good fingers.
No, I see the potential here. And
but it's such a difficult life to be a horn player.
Tell me about it. With the horn, you never know if what you blow in is going to come out.
It's true. It's a really hard. I'm not sure if I wish that on him.
Well, I don't wish that on him, but I wish that on you right now, because to end the Deutsche Grammophon International podcasts, I like to challenge whoever I've interviewed to getting a note on the horn. Now, you've been looking very suspiciously at this, at my horn sitting here between us for the whole podcast. I would love to challenge you to playing it.
Is your horn insured?
My horn is insured. We're going to take your...
Oh, I'd rather have it there. Then I feel a sense of security.
No, that's good. Well, we'll put it back in here then. Then we're going to put that here.
Yeah, it's not going to affect anything. Go.
And this is my mouthpiece. So just for the listeners, so to know what's about to happen. That would be a sort of normal warm-up on the horn. It's freezing cold.
You know, I've never played a single note on the horn.
You've never played a single note
like,
on the horn?
Not one. Even if one of my very best friends is the principal horn player of Iceland Symphony, Stefan Jan.
Stefan, yeah.
I find my heart is beating a little faster now.
Well, I'm glad, because the horn should make your heart flutter. And in these days of staying healthy, I have a
what
sterilized
mouth. What if
there's
no sound? It's like playing the piano and it's just muted.
You know,
there probably is no sound when I play it.
Here is a sterilized mouthpiece that's going in the horn. I'm just making sure the horn, I don't know if you can hear that on the, we're blowing air through the horn and wiggling the valves. Now a sterilized mouthpiece is, now anybody can get a note on the horn. All you have to do is put your lips together and pretend you're spitting something off your lips. It goes, you pull the tongue back.
Okay.
With a vibration. Try that.
God.
Spit. That's it. But a little bit longer, a little bit. Yeah, that's exactly it. I can hear everybody at home listening to this podcast in front of their thing going. It's basically, kids can always do it, because you say kids spit off what you have on the end of your tongue and they go. There you go. That's all you have to do.
But I think there's no sound coming.
Well, we'll see. The worse you are, the more we love you.
Mm.
So here we go.
Here we are.
Am I pronouncing your name right?
Víkingur.
Víkingur. Ready? Here we go. You're a natural talent.
But what if we? I want to do a scale.
Bravo. Okay.
But do I have to do it with my mouth and with these three.
And with the valves. That's right. You can do it. You can do a natural harmonic and just go up and down.
Okay, this is kind of fun.
Yeah, it's kind of fun. You see. And the thing is with the podcast is once I give them the horn, dear listeners, they never want to stop. So we're going to let Víkingur play
Amazing.
Us out. He will not stop here. He's going to carry on. Yeah, bravo.
It sound so beautifully in the Berlin Philharmonic. And here I am Thank with you. That same horn.
Thank you for joining us. Thank you for this beautiful Debussy Rameau album.
I sound like a sick elephant.
Yes, well, it can only get better. Thank you so much
Thanks,
for
Sarah.
Joining us.